makes it most powerful rocket in use today. More powerful than what the Russians are launching. More powerful than the Delta IV that I just mentioned, the Delta IV Heavy. The only other thing more powerful than the Falcon 9 was the shuttle, and I was just a million or so pounds more than this. And eventually, when they upgrade the boosters, the Falcon Heavy might even beat the shuttle thrust liftoff, which was normally around 5.5-6 million pounds for the thrust on the shuttle. If they can get it up to 7.5 million pounds, they won't be able to do that, but then that would be equivalent to the Saturn V, the one that took our astronauts to the moon. The Russians had two vehicles. They had the N1, which launched four different times, but failed tragically every time. Never had anybody on board, but would go up and blow up. Another one blew up in the pad. And that had 30 engines on the bottom. They had problems mixing the fuel, going from one to the other. All kinds of problems with the pumps that used to pump the fuel. So they failed three different times. But that was a big rocket. That was actually bigger than the Saturn V. That had 10 million pounds of thrust. But it never went up. So that really doesn't count. And then Roscosmos had another one. That's, you know, the Russians had Energia, and that was a little bit more powerful than the Falcon Heavy as well. And they only used that two different times in Russia. So the goal was to test the vehicle and put a payload into orbit. Well, he went one step further. It went into Earth orbit, but then he had the second stage still attached to it, and he pushed the payload out of Earth orbit and accelerated it up to about 7 miles per second. To do that, they had to go from 5 miles. 5 miles per second is usually the average speed for Earth orbit. They had to get it up to 7 miles per second to get it out of Earth orbit and on a trajectory toward Mars, which succeeded. And the payload was this bizarre idea, but it did work. He put an automobile inside, a Tesla Roadster, convertible car, and inside the car, sitting in the driver's seat, was what looked like a person would be inside of a spacesuit. He took one of his spacesuits that he's manufacturing for the crew version of the Dragon and put the spacesuit in the car in the driver's seat. He's got one hand on the steering wheel and the other one leaning on the door of the car. And he went up. The booster stage, separated. The core stage, the center one, kept going. And eventually that separated. The second stage took over, pushed the car out of Earth orbit, 6 hours later after it was launched, and headed toward the direction of Mars. He thinks it's going to overshoot the... He thought it was going to be around the orbit of Mars. Elon Musk says it's going to be out around the asteroid belt now. And then it's going to come back around and eventually go around the sun and again, then sometimes go near Earth and back to the near Mars orbit and around for the next billion years or so. So here's this car floating in space, and it's an alien race in a billion years finds it from now. They'll theoretically find this car. I think the car is going to get destroyed from radioactivity, maybe over the years. I don't know. The paint wasn't really designed to last, or the seats, or something I think might deteriorate over those billion years. But who knows, they might still find something all those eons from now. And then he was playing a song on the radio. He played a song, Life on Mars was the song. Supposed to be coming out of the radio. You heard it. You could hear the transmission. And I thought to myself, well, this can't be coming out of the radio. And sure, he has a speaker and a dashboard. Or the doors of the car. But this thing's in a vacuum. So where was that sound coming from? I still haven't found out yet. You know, was it really coming from being transmitted from space? Some kind of a digital, program just being sent down over and over? Or was it being transmitted from Hawthorne, California? I still haven't figured that one out yet. Which is Hawthorne, California, by the way, is mission control for SpaceX. But I thought that was interesting. Let me drop it. And their big photo op, which everybody really was impressed by, the news media really liked it, was the two boosters that were coming, that came back down. Elon Musk is all about retrieving everything. His goal would be to retrieve every part of the spacecraft. And he's been doing this quite a while now, quite a few years. He's recovered about 20 boosters now. So two of the boosters, this is the first time they shot up three at one time, and two of the boosters was set to come back to landing zone one. Landing zone one is he took over a launch complex that's not used in Florida. It was called Launch Complex 13. He just shoot rockets up there years ago. Well, he leveled that. It was pretty much a level anyway, but he put these two big concrete circles with the logo for SpaceX, Big X, in the middle of it. And here comes these two the boosters coming back at the exact same time. These big aluminum fins open up, guiding it through the atmosphere. The rockets come on again. Not all nine, but three. To slow it down as it's coming toward the landing zone. And then at the very end, one other rocket comes on, the center rocket. And everything's gimbaled so they can move these rockets around. So that the booster stays vertical. And it lands right on target. Both of them at the exact same time. Very impressive. If you haven't seen that, you have to find that on the internet. It's amazing. I've seen many of the flights come down before, and, it's always been one. One will come back to landing zone one. Or the other time, they'll send it out to the barge. He's got a floating barge out in the ocean. He'll land on that. But this time he had two aerodynamic cones on the top of each booster. Because, when it was going to go through the atmosphere, when it was going up, it needed to have that. Couldn't have just flat top. And I was wondering, if he was going to have those separate and come back. Usually when you see the booster come down, you don't see anything on the top. It's just a flat top on the booster. But this time, the aerodynamic cones, they stay attached to the booster. And you can see them in the video coming down. If you look at any of the other videos or pictures of a Falcon 9 that has landed, you always see it's just a flat top on the top of the booster. Each booster is like a 15-story building. It's WS2N, and they're about 12 feet in diameter. The core was supposed to land on the barge. He's got a barge out a couple hundred miles out in the ocean in the Atlantic. And the name of the barge is, of course, I Still Love You. He's got another barge exactly like it out in the Pacific Ocean for when he does Pacific launches. And and that was supposed to land on a barge. He successfully has done this quite many times, probably at least 10 times in the Pacific or in the Atlantic, but this time it didn't work out. The booster was coming back down, and apparently all of the three edges, usually when they're coming down to land on the barge, they need, when they're doing a barge landing, they need three engines to come on at the same time. And at the very last second, it's usually just one. But those three engines didn't come on, just two of them came on. And they figured out that they ran out of igniter fluid. These fluids that they use are really essentially kerosene. It's called RP1, refined kerosene, and also liquid oxygen. But when you mix those two together, they don't ignite. They need an igniter. So he has these cartridges, and they're loaded with TTAP. TTAP, that's TEA, and then another chemical called TEB. When these two come out, and you know they get anywhere near oxygen, and even cold liquid oxygen, it doesn't matter, it will ignite. And if you ever look at these launchers up close, you see like a greenish look. That's the TTAP combination, and they apparently ran out of fuel on that center booster. That's happened before, many flights ago. So I think he knows how to correct that. And it came screaming down. I haven't seen a video yet of it, but it came down and hit the water at 300 miles an hour. So here's this 15-story cylinder that was completely destroyed. They said it washed over, created a... it was so close to the barge that it damaged part of the barge. If you look at the video, you can see that everything got dark for a second, so that must have been the splash water or something coming up. Everything just went dark. So that was the only part that really was not successful, but he didn't care about that. All he wanted to do was get this thing off the launch pad and not destroy Launch Complex 39A. This is the complex that was used by shuttles for many years before that Saturn V. And he didn't want to spend a year rebuilding that, like he did on Launch Complex 40, when a couple of years ago the Falcon 9 blew up on that pad. Since then, he's rebuilt that pad. So what's next for SpaceX? Many flights. Last year he did, I think it was 19 flights. You know, both either from California or from Florida. And he's got that many, if not more, planned for this year, including two more Falcon Heavy launches, what we saw go off on February 6th. He's got two more planned for this year. And then many other single stick launches. And he's all about bringing parts back. He wants to try to save everything, including these fairings. You know, the fairing on this last rocket, that's the enclosed, the piece that encloses the payload on the top. It's 5 meters. It's actually 5.2 meters, so roughly 17 feet in diameter, and over 40 feet tall. So, you know, he could put a large payload in this thing. He only had the little car inside with the so-called astronaut, the spacesuit sitting on the seat. But he would like to be able to save these big bearings. So in the past, he's been practicing. He puts little nitrogen jets in, to be able to maneuver these fairings when they open up and separate. He's trying to control where they land in the ocean. So he's even gone as far as putting parachutes on them. And the reason he wants to save these things, that they're like $6 million a piece every time he makes these things. they're very expensive. He would like to be able to save them and reuse them. So now he's got the great, he's got another idea. He's got this big, pretty large boat. I think it's around almost 300 feet long. He's got this boat that he's put together in California. I guess we'll eventually have one on the East Coast. And I'm assuming there's probably going to be two boats, but right now I know of one. And he's got these massive outriggers sticking out of this thing, sticking up at like a 45-degree angle. Like there are four of them coming out, you know, two on the port side, two on the starboard side. And with this big net, you know. I don't know what he's thinking. I think he's just going to go out and probably, you know, with some other device, take the, you know, pick the bearings up. It'll be, you know, a half at a time, because they split open. And he'll take a half a bearing. I think he's going to have somehow put the massive thing up into the net. And one guy, when I was reading about it, he said, well, maybe he's going to try to catch it falling out of the sky. And knowing this guy, he probably would. But he's got these boats. He's going to go 200-400 miles out in the ocean, and not only bring the booster back on these barges, which he's been doing, but he wants to bring the bearing back. So far, he's recovered one half of a bearing about a year and a half ago, and he's worked on that little by little. And after that, toward the end of this year, he's got an upgraded booster that he's building, Falcon 9. They call it Block 5. It's going to be the final iteration of all these different boosters. You know, these things have been evolving since he started off with the Falcon 1, which was one engine, and then he was going to make the Falcon 5. He gave up that idea. He just went right to the Falcon 9. And then he upgraded that booster. You know, things changed. And in some cases, drastically, the first few Falcon 9s that went up, if you looked at the engine pattern at the very bottom, if you looked at the very bottom, how they were laid out, there was, you know, it looked like 9 engines. But, you know, kind of like a dice, you know, they were all lined up, 3, 3, 3, you know. So he changed that to an octagon type of setup. They were arranged around the circumference, and then one in the middle. And he did that because it's easier to have these things, this whole big rocket on a rolling jig type of thing. He's able to roll them and install and work on each engine. You know, if he wants to work on the other one, he can roll the whole setup over and work on another engine. You know, and now Block 5 is an improvement over Block 2 and 3. There was, each one is an improvement. The original ones didn't have fins on them. The original ones didn't have legs on them. This one will have titanium fins. They're bigger, also bigger at the very top. The legs are going to be much more improved. He's improving on the legs. The legs themselves will be reusable. The ones that he uses now, he has to take off. And they're not really, you know, he can reuse some parts of it, but the new ones will be, you know, he'll be able to collapse them and reuse them. The whole booster itself will be reusable up to 10 times, with the ones that he's using now, he just reuses them once and then he throws them away. And this improved new booster will also have thrust, more thrust, 7 or 8% more thrust, and the coating on the outside of the Falcon 9 will have more of a thermal shield to protect it as it re-enters the atmosphere, so there'll be less maintenance getting one to fly again. So he's also going to have like a heat shield. If you look at all the engines on the bottom, above the, where the engine sit, he's created a heat shield. And the idea of that is to, you know, protect all the piping and all the valves and electronics, whatever he's got down there. And, you know, it will be a lot less problems. And he could use these things up to 10 times and then rebuild them and then use them another 10 times. And he'll be able to reuse each booster up to 100 different times. So that's his goal, and then after he's finished playing with these boosters, the next couple of years, he's going to be sending his engineers to put more work into developing his completely different rocket, the what he calls the, originally it was called the ITS, Interplanetary Transportation System. And now he's got other names for it. But this big rocket is the one that will eventually be as big. It will actually be bigger than the Saturn V rocket. So I think that's quite a few years down the road. But that's what he's going to be working on. He'll keep flying the Falcon 9s and eventually work on the new rocket that will eventually take him to the Moon and Mars and wherever he wants to go. This is WS2N for Space Report. Any questions? And if not, we can go on to other topics. Anybody have any comments? Okay. Let's see if there's anybody else that wants to hear that topic or any other topics. We have an infinite supply of space topics. But I thought that would be the main one for tonight. Any comments? This is WS2N.
Paul, any comments about the memory crystal that he included in the car?
What was that about? I glanced over that. What did you read about that, Roy?
It's a fascinating thing. It's basically a silica-based optical disk. Apparently, it stores as much as 360 terabytes of information, and theoretically, it's supposed to last 14 billion years, but I don't know who the hell you go to complain if the warranty doesn't work out that well. But and they encoded it with the Asimov's trilogy, the Foundation trilogy, which is amusing because Foundation Trilogy was supposedly about the Encyclopedia Galactica.
Yeah, I gotta read up on more science fiction. I know he likes these. What is it? Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and all this. But on that memory thing that he put on there, is that the one that he inscribed the 6,000 names of everybody that works at SpaceX? And it sounds like a low number, 6,000 people. You know, when I think of the Apollo program, Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, you know, through those years, you had corporations and companies that were involved with this. All right, I know it was a lot more than what Elon Musk is doing now, but there was 400,000 people involved in the space program. You know, he's got just one section of it, but all those 6,000 names apparently were inscribed on something that I read.
Well, there certainly was enough space. I mean, 300 terabytes of space, but the only thing that all the news reports mentioned were three books. And of course, apparently it's engraved with instructions on how to decode it if there's no players available in 14 billion years. I'm sure they must have encoded other bits and pieces that'll slowly leak out when press agents kind of need a little bit extra publicity.
Very good. I think someday it's all coming back to Earth if we're still here. What's going to happen? Yeah, it will be into orbit. They can, you could say, for a million or billion years, you know, without hitting anything. Probably likely. But I think what's more likely is, you know, as space travel gets cheaper and cheaper, and we start living on the moon like that book Artemis, or maybe Mars colonies, or some of the other moons around Saturn, like Titan. And you have all these different, you know, locations throughout the solar system, and it just becomes so common. What's to stop somebody from saying, I think I'm going to take a ride out there, and, you know, with a big scoop, a big net, or maybe a big magnet, you know, that car is magnetic, and grab a hold of it and bring it back to Earth and put it in a nice museum. I think that's more likely to happen than have this thing going in orbit around the sun and, you know, for the next billion years.
I guess if we don't blow ourselves up, if technology advances, maybe someday we'll be able to do things like that. That would be nice.
Yeah, I'm also fascinated by, I don't know if I included that in the letter I sent you, but the reporters of today, you know, they spend a lot of time on other topics, politics, money, weather, but a lot of them don't get involved in the space program anymore. You have so many people dedicated to it. Bergen and Horowitz and John Holloman, that was his name, Holloman. Miles O'Brien, he was fantastic. Although I did see him do a report on CNN, I was glad to see him come back for a little bit and do a report on this particular launch. But most of the other reports, like I saw this one guy, he said, I wonder how they get that car out of that rocket. I wonder if they just open up the cargo bay and let him out. You can see the guy, you know, he's thinking like years ago when, you know, we had the shuttle. They really don't keep up on this stuff. It's amazing. You know, I find that I'm fascinated with the reporting, what goes on. Another guy was saying, oh yeah, they're going to use this, those boosters that came down, they're going to reuse them over and over and over. You know, I already know that both boosters are, you know, scheduled for the scrapyard. Back to you, Roy. AC2GSWS2M.
AC2GS. What can I tell you? Unfortunately, the most romantic, adventurous project NASA has is still Apollo. People aren't engaged. You know, the first few shuttles were exciting, and then the next few shuttles, and then one blew up, and everyone's kind of gone around, and it's all old hat. I mean, that's why when I saw the rockets go off, I said, gee, the rocket went off. But when it landed without a parachute, that's something new. So you got to give the crowd something new, something exciting, and they'll come back. As it is, news agencies, there's no money to be made with a dedicated space reporter. It's too few and too far between. So some guy who was doing sports last Wednesday is kind of told to go there and say something.
Yes, that's exactly what happens. And meanwhile, I'm trying to learn more from this. And sometimes they come up with something I haven't heard. But I don't know. Here's one other topic. The Image satellite is the one, I know we were talking about it, but a couple of weeks ago. But now there's further information on it. If you go to the NASA website, they pretty much give you details on what transpired. The image satellite was launched in 2000, year 2000, and it was successfully launched from California Vandenberg Air Force Base with a Delta II rocket. It had three solid boosters attached to it. This thing went up. It went into a very high orbit, like planned, 24,000 miles out, and then the perigee was a lot lower, like 500 miles. And it was about a 14-hour orbit. And it worked great. The idea was to investigate the magnetosphere of Earth. And you know, this whole magnetic field that we have surrounding us. And it successfully did that for like 5 years, almost 5 years. So the image satellite, all of a sudden, they had problems. The mission control was looking at this thing, and no response, no nothing. And over time, they figured out that they thought the computers on board had failed for some one reason or another. An A side and a B side for this computer to be working. And they think a cosmic ray or something might have got into this. And it has sensors on board and the electronics, and it sensed that we have an over voltage or something. So it kind of like shut it down like a circuit breaker. Shut it down, and then there's a threshold that the voltage is supposed to come back up to. The threshold was set too low. So whenever the voltage came back up, what happened was the computer thought it wasn't high enough, and it just never brought everything back to life again. So that's what they figured out in 2005. So what happened was, it's a dead issue. No, this satellite is gone forever. And they forgot about it. Since then, we've had other satellites detecting the magnetosphere. A couple of very successful ones. BMMS is up there now. They have four of them at one time, investigating the magnetic field. But lo and behold, here's this ham radio operator in Canada. His name was Scott Tilley, VE7TIL, Victor Echo 7, Tango, Italy, Lima. And this guy has got all kinds of antennas in his house. He's really into radio astronomy and all of this, and he's able to listen to the satellites. And sure enough, they had a launch not too long ago, last month. And it was called the Zuma launch, Z-U-M-A. It was a top secret military satellite that was going up, the SpaceX launch. And it's a successful launch, but the satellite was lost. What happened to the satellite? And now, this guy, he's not only an amateur, ham radio amateur, he's an amateur astronomer. And he's got the equipment. And he's searching for the signal for the Zuma spacecraft. Nothing. And then he got a recording device. He's able to record the signal. So he goes to bed. He wakes up the next morning, and then he's starting to review the signals, and he came across the signal. He says, look at this. This is a pretty strong signal. Not too strong, but it's... And he found out it couldn't be the Zuma satellite, but what else could it be? So he looked through all the catalogs, and he's got all kinds of connections on the internet, and he found out that he believes it was the image satellite all these years later, from 2005. So Scott Tilley gets on the internet, and he's trying to get more and more information, and the story goes, and it's a NASA site, talking with his wife, and the wife says, smart enough with all this electronics and stuff, you could contact somebody that was involved with this. So he proceeded to do that, and inside of a day or so, he made contact with the principal investigator. And I have a guy's name here somewhere, but he was the main guy back then, all the science and everything behind the satellite. He gets a hold of the guy, and the guy starts wondering. And he's worried that, you know, nobody's going to believe this guy with all these antennas all over his house. And, you know, they're going to think he's nuts. But sure enough, the guy, he said, you know, what you're telling me sounds feasible. He got the Netherlands involved to track the signal of the image satellite. He got, you know, next thing you know, there were many receiving stations looking to find out if this was it. And there was some kind of a code that would be transmitted from the satellite, and it was 166, and that would prove that it was the satellite. And they had to figure out, you know, if this thing was transmitting that signal. The problem was the, you know, back in 2005, and actually 2000, that the protocol and everything that was done for this thing has been done away with. We, you know, we're into new stuff. So they put a request out, I guess, on the internet or something to find out, to see if anybody had this old protocol, whatever they were using. Sure enough, they got a call from somebody that worked on one of the old satellites in 1995 who had a copy of this software program, whatever they needed. And sure enough, they plugged it in somewhere and sat there, and they decoded 166, and were 100% sure that it was the image satellite. So now, NASA's, you know, the Applied Physics Group in Maryland, they're the ones that are involved with this. They're working on trying to actually transmit up to the satellite down and see if they can. They know it has valuable data on it, that it was stored, you know, stored data. And they also know that, you know, one of the pieces of information the satellite sent back to them was that the batteries are now 100% charged. And to make a long story short, they finally found out really what was, you know, what was wrong with this thing. This whole threshold thing was wrong, and why it got reset. The reason it got reset is because sometimes it goes into this eclipse. It goes into, you know, the dark side of the Earth for a real long period of time. And if that happens, the satellite detects it, you know, says, okay, you know, we're dead. So its clock tells it next time we come back out and, you know, into the light and start getting our battery charged, we're going to make, you know, we're going to actually reboot the computer. And that's what they think happened. It went so dead that it rebooted itself. And now they want to find out if they can transmit to it. Eventually, they're going to transmit a signal to change this threshold of wherever this voltage level was, to so that the satellite, you know, doesn't quit again, you know, like it did in 2005. And if they can bring it back, they're going to use it for science. They're going to, you know, first of all, get all the old data off of it and use it for more science. To think about what it would cost to send another rocket up, and this whole contraption that went up with the rocket and everything was $180 million in, you know, 2005 time frame. So, you know, you think about what did VE7 TIL save us from, you know, the taxpayer of sending another satellite up, and he did it all for free from his backyard. Any comments or questions? This is WS2M for the Space Net Report for the TechNet. Okay, I got nothing else. Any comments from anybody about any questions, comments dealing with the space topic? Or if not, we'll continue. We'll turn it back to Dick. This is W.
did you hear that Mike guy in California who's trying to fire a steam-driven rocket tried again last Saturday?
Is this the guy that we were talking about a while back? He's trying to duplicate what Evel Knievel did, except, yeah, okay, yeah, this is the guy, he's doing this all on his own, and, he's gonna shoot, where's he gonna, down by the beach? What's he gonna do, shoot himself in the backyard? Or is this a case of, believe it or not, back to you, Roy.
I guess ultimately it depends on how crazy this guy, and he is called Mad Mike, so he could be quite crazy. But he was going to do it again last Saturday, sometime in the afternoon, and people got together and started to take pictures of the event, and absolutely nothing happened. And towards the end of the day, someone muttered something about an O-ring not working, and it's back on hold again. So Mad Mike has not shot himself. I think it changes every hour and a half. He feet up in the air, he plans to shoot himself, but not terribly high. I think it was something like 1,600 feet or something in last report. So it's a question whether this guy will ever have an opportunity to basically kill himself or not.
Wow. What, did he give himself an alliterative name? Mad Mike. Or is that a news report? Is this guy any relative to the guy that got into his launch pad and hooked up a couple of hundred helium balloons and took off and started flying around? Is he related? Maybe it's the same guy.
I don't know. I saw an animation of someone who did something like that, but I don't recall the person who actually tried to do those things. Now, I think he likes the title Mad Mike. I think he's a publicity hawk. So he's going to squeeze as much publicity out of this without killing himself, is my guess. But again, it all depends upon how true his name is. How mad is Mad Mike?
W-H-R-Y-Y. Neighbor, let me know when you're doing this. I'm going on vacation. You know, like the pictures of this guy coming through my living room. Now, I haven't seen any pictures of it. Did you see any, what the rocket looked like or anything? Or is this, you know, what's the story on that? Did they release any information, pictures, or details? Is the rocket 10 feet long, 100 feet long? What's he doing?
Yeah, there are pictures of it in everything. He has stenciled across the fuselage flat earth. It looks like it's maybe something like 20 feet tall. It's difficult to say because, you know, it's at an angle and you can't really get a good sense of perspective. But there's pictures of it. There were guys trying to turn it into a news item last Saturday. And obviously, what kind of a news item can you do about a rocket that doesn't go anyplace?
Okay. Some people have great ideas, and some people think really can't afford to do it right. People have crazy ideas like Elon Musk, but he's got to pull it off, like putting that car into space. That's incredible. And I wonder if anybody in the future is going to say, well, that was fake. You know, look, that's a fake picture. Going to get those people. Back in the 60s, and I remember, you know, when the space program was really going up full blast, you know, with Mercury and Gemini, and they were talking about Apollo, and we're going to be going to the moon on a regular basis. There was a guy who wanted to take a 1955, he was an artist type of guy. He was, you know, really into bizarre art, you know, one of these guys that would put, you know, sheets all over the George Washington Bridge and call it art, you know, that type of guy. And he wanted to take a 55 Chevy and land it on the moon and have, you know, take pictures of this thing. He thought that would be the coolest thing going. And that's what this Elon Musk thing reminds me of, you know. It's like this guy, you know, came back to life, and now he's a billionaire, and he's doing the same thing. I wouldn't be surprised if Musk brings a car with him to Mars one day. You know, he's that type of guy. Back to you, Roy, WS2N.
AC2GS. Well, the beauty is that Elon Musk is a great showman, which is just as important as being innovative. You have to sell it. And he sells it very nicely. I mean, the cherry red car, the whole nine yards. I mean, it made a great picture and it made a great story. But as far as people being paranoid, you could never underestimate the paranoia of human beings. I am willing to bet you anything that there are presently people furiously typing on their own little personal web pages that this has all been make-believe, that it was done in a studio someplace. The only question is, was it a studio in California or a studio in London?
Yeah. Capricorn 1, an old movie. I depicted that, you know, they had, I think that was a Mars mission, and the whole thing was, you know, they never left Earth, the astronauts, and they were all in on it, you know. So, now, talking about the guy in, where's California, the guy with the steam rocket, maybe he watched that movie, what was the other movie? Astronaut Farmer, and I'm bad with names. He's a famous actor, and he plays this part, and he's got a farm out in the middle of nowhere, and he puts together this what looked like a Gemini rocket, but he wanted to take off in his backyard. He actually encased it in a barn or something. I don't know if you ever saw that thing. It's actually a pretty good movie.
No, I missed that one, but I've been rereading Heinlein, and I recently read Rocket Ship Galileo, and it's surprising how much chemistry and science and physics Heinlein crammed into a book for kids. And one of the characters was an amateur radio operator. It was basically about a Nobel Prize winner and three teenagers who were pretty smart and could build things. And their own ship and take it all the way to the moon. And the funny thing is, Heinlein suggested in the book that if a business invested in some project like that, it would cost over $1.25 million to budget like that. So can you imagine what he would have made of the actual NASA budget?
Yeah, what NASA's up to, roughly $19.5 billion, you know. And that's nothing compared to the Air Force, and, you know, just all these different rockets. NRO, National Reconnaissance Office. You know, these spy satellites and things. Program, the defense program is almost three times, they said a little over two times, but I think it's like three times the cost of what the NASA budget is. But they're just for their space portion of the military. That's kind of shocking. People don't realize that. You know, most of the rockets that shoot off all year long that I follow are not NASA flights. They're military, you know, from the United States. And then the other half that you see launches from different countries. And, yeah, I start reading more science fiction. Get off the, the other books are good. You know, I read, like, it's Brian Greene with, you know, physics. Well, I haven't seen him lately. Had a couple of shows. I have a couple of his books. I don't know if you've ever read anything from him. Green, G-R-E-E-N-E. Back to your work.
Yeah, Yeah, I've read Brian Greene. I kind of agree with him. He has a very weird theory about parallel universes and what dark energy and dark matter might be. At least he did when he wrote the books. He might have changed his mind recently. I don't know. But, yeah, I've read Brian Greene. I think he's a smart guy, and he writes reasonably well, and he doesn't write down to people. There are some guys who are brilliant, but they tend to write down when they write popular books, and they sort of confuse the heck out of other physicists because the other physicists are asked to explain stuff that makes no sense, and they just shrug and walk away. So I like Brian Greene. He's a good author. But I love the old science fiction. I grew up on it. It's part of me, and it's nice to go and visit it again. It's sort of amazing how well it stands up over time. I mean, Galileo, I think, was written in 1947. And it's still a good read.
Yeah. Wonder what the guy would have thought. You know, there really was a Galileo spacecraft that orbited Jupiter for, I think it was 5.5 years before that mission came to an end. They looked at all the moons and all. I guess he'd be old now. It was back then in the 40s. But they actually had a Galileo spacecraft. They would have got a kick out of that. Now we have the GPS system for the United States. European Space Agency is launching a constellation of satellites, and they're called Galileo. That's their name for their GPS satellites that they're putting up. So this guy would have been thrilled to see all these Galileo names out there. We got 3 minutes left. Back to you, Roy. AC2GSWS2N.
Well, he's a very popular historical figure, and he deserves it on many levels. I mean, he did a lot of fundamental research. He didn't invent the telescope. Some people are a little confused. He just improved upon the design. But, you know, it always kind of rankles me that the poor guy got stuck house arrest for a major portion of his life. And, you know, the Roman Catholic Church, I think, apologized 10, 15 years ago. Gee, I wonder if they were able to reach him for a comment.
Yeah, well, you know, he grew up in tough times. They had their beliefs, and that was it. And they didn't believe, I don't think, in separation of religion and state. And that's what they wound up with. No, I mean, whatever they said was it. And if he didn't retract his statements, it would have wound up worse for him than just being locked up under house arrest. No. But, you know, the word got out eventually. He did the world a lot of good. There's a good book by Carl Sagan, and I think it's called The Demon Haunted World, Science, A Candle in the Dark. If you read that one, that is probably one of the better books of all time. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it's where you live that determines it, also when you live. Copernicus lived around the same time, but fortunately for him, he lived in Prussian Germany. So it was the Reformation, and the Roman Catholic Church really didn't have much power there. But poor Galileo lived in Florence, so he was out of luck.
That's true. Okay, we're running out of time. I don't know if Dick is still with us or not. I'll give him a call, and otherwise we'll be coming to a grinding halt very shortly. K2RIW, WS2N.
Yeah, we have used up the time. That was TechNet 1687. That was Space Report number 287. 73, you all. Be kind to each other, and see you next week. K2RIW, TechNet, Landmark. We're clear, and bye-bye for now.
Okay, 73, Dick. I tell you it was going to be a great neck. Very good. Very good net. Roy, 73, have a good one. We'll see you in the emails or next week. AT2GS, WS2M.
Okey-doke, 73 Dick, 73 Paul, 73 to everyone who listened to our little presentation. I hope you enjoyed it, and please send me questions. The email is mailbag@limartech.net. Any question that reaches your fancy, feel free to ask me these things. And we'll all be back next week. Have a great week, guys.